Hello, my name is Liz Crow and I'm currently the Staff Wellbeing Consultant, Counsellor, Coach and Educator at the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital. However, clinically, I have worked for the last 25 years previously at the Queensland Children's Hospital, predominantly in paediatric intensive care and critical care.
Welcome, Liz. Thank you for joining us. As you said in your introduction, you're a Staff Wellbeing Consultant. Is that a fairly new role in the health system and what does it involve?
It is. It's a brand spanking new role and I commenced in that in October last year, 2020. I think Metro North here is making huge gains in terms of what we're doing for wellbeing, and so they have the Bruce Sullivan as the Chief Wellbeing Officer. They have the Values in Action Group. Across Metro North, they've just started some peer responder positions in all of the hospitals, and we also have a staff psychologist. So I think Metro North, probably more than other areas of Queensland Health, have had this real focus in wellbeing, and the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital executive wanted some additional time to really focus in on their staff and the staff culture, and so I've brought into the organisation to do that work.
And Liz, what does it say about the importance that the health system places on staff wellness to have a position such as yours?
Look, I think people had for the first time really been brought to the fore how important staff wellbeing has been with all, like the last decade, there's been so much research has come out around staff wellbeing and the connection between the quality of care, the level of safety, the error rates, the sick leave, all of those things are related to staff wellbeing. However, I think COVID has tipped it into the real fore where we've really come to recognise that our staff are our greatest asset and resource and that we really need to look after them. And so I think, you know, congratulations that so many organisations now have gone from really the only wellbeing that was being done previously was by well-intentioned clinicians who, in addition to their time, and I was the same, were doing things in their, and I put in inverted commas, spare time. And now we're actually seeing paid positions commencing.
And Liz, staff wellbeing has been an interest of yours for many years. Where did that interest come from and what research have you done in this area?
Yeah, so I've been interested in staff wellbeing for a long time, working in the critical care space, obviously, unfortunately exposed to lots of death and trauma and heartache from patients, and that does it does affect you, obviously, as a clinician. I actually heard a terrible story maybe about 8 years ago about two young police officers who attended a suicide and made some black humour about the whole thing, you know, some gallows humour, and were reprimanded. And it really got me thinking about, you know, there's no kind of preparation. There's nothing in the world that can prepare you for some of the things that we will be exposed to in health. And what are we doing about that? And I guess at the same time, I really came to realise that we're very lucky in Australia that we've got this lovely multicultural population now. And in our staff, we've got a lovely multicultural backgrounds, which brings great diversity and great wealth of knowledge to our teams. But it also means that not everyone's sense of humour is the same. Not everyone gets to leave at the end of a difficult day and have a partner or a parent or someone even in the same time zone. And so that I felt it was time to kind of understand more about that. And for me, the literature at the time didn't provide that. And so I very foolishly decided to embark on a PhD on staff wellbeing in critical care environments, which I have to laugh has destroyed my own wellbeing, and I'm still not finished it. But it's part of that. I've looked at burnout, meaning making, satisfaction with life and psychological distress within the critical care environment. And because I'm very distractible and I haven't finished, I've also done some research around, we're looking at the moment around ethical climates in healthcare. I've done some studies around moral distress. Last year, myself and Naomi Hammond and the group from the George Institute did one of the largest COVID wellbeing studies, which we're just running the second arm for that now. So if you're a healthcare professional and get the survey, please complete it. And I've also done some qualitative studies as well around stories that haunt ED consultants. So quite a range of things. And I think our knowledge around all of that is getting much greater depth. But what's been missing is, what do we actually do to address those issues.
And Liz, you've spoken overseas on wellbeing of staff.
Yeah, look, I've been podcasting with a group called St. Emlyn's for a very long time, and then as a result of that got involved with the SMAC, which is the Social Media and Critical Care Group, which during COVID, you know, we became CODA. We were doing three podcasts a week at the commencement of COVID last year, really just trying to help our international colleagues everywhere get ahead of things. So we interviewed people like Martin Bromley about human factors and COVID. We, you know, put a podcast out about how to help people make phone calls to family members after a death, you know, a whole range of issues, clinical and non-clinical, just trying to reach people who were overwhelmed and finding some way to streamline information that people could access it quickly.
How well were they received?
Really well. Look, some of them were phenomenal. I also was podcasting just with a range of people who needed some support, and the Pediatrica Intensiva group did the first interview with an Italian ICU consultant, and I think that got 80,000 downloads. Then we interviewed a New York ICU consultant, and you know, their stories were phenomenal. You know, the guy we interviewed from New York was from a 14-bed ICU, within 24 hours was a 100-bed ICU, and within 48 hours was a 200-bed ICU. And he was saying, if you're a doctor or nurse who'd ever even walked past the doors of ICU, you had a ventilated patient, and talking about intubating, you know, 19 people in a 14-hour shift, and when the buzzer would go off and people are having cardiac arrest, people having to choose which bed they would actually be able to go to. So, you know, like, it really, for me, made me realise how lucky we've been in Australia. First of all, just because of our geography, but also the decisions that our politicians and Queensland Health have made that have really meant that for many of us in Queensland, we've had some minor inconveniences. I mean, I'm not talking about people who obviously have been impacted by not being able to go to funerals and weddings, but for the bulk of our population, we've had some minor inconveniences. But compared to our colleagues overseas, it's been horrific.
In situations like that, Liz, how are these clinicians managing their own wellbeing?
Look, I'd have to say for the whole of last year, every single person we interviewed, the people that were podcasting with us, because they're all clinicians, they're all professors of emergency medicine or ICU or their nursing staff, people were so busy trying to provide excellent care, run their teams, keep themselves safe, keep their families safe, and come up with policies, procedures, working out, you know, interventions, how to prone people, medications, that I think they just were all running on adrenaline. But what I've noticed this year is that most of those people have not had a single, you know, weekend fully off from work, and the fatigue for them is really starting to wear. And I feel concerned for many people overseas, because once COVID, you know, we are seeing a rapid decline in COVID numbers and in mortality and in morbidity with the introductions to the vaccinations. But we're still going to have people who are sick and people who have accidents. It's not like the healthcare system can say, you know what, we've done it really tough, so we're just going to close this hospital down for a couple of days and everyone's going to have a break. So that makes me very concerned for our overseas colleagues.
So Liz, in early 2020, COVID-19 reached our shores. How have you been involved in the response?
Across a number of ways. As I said, you know, CODA versus COVID was our podcast three times a week, and that kept us all extremely busy trying to find people who could speak, and then, you know, coordinating time zones for podcasting internationally is a nightmare, and it's usually the Australians that miss out, and of course, because Queensland's not on daylight saving, it was often off an hour earlier than everybody else. So we've done that. As I said, we ran our research project, which we got nearly 4,000 surveys back. And from that, there were some really powerful messages from around the world. And what was interesting was that we ran the DAS, which looks at depression, anxiety and stress. And in February last year, it didn't matter if you were from China or if you're in UK or Italy or you're in Australia and had not seen a single COVID patient. For healthcare professionals, the anxiety and stress was exactly the same, because I think it's that whole there's nothing worse to fear than fear itself. And I think for many healthcare professionals early last year, it was like knowing there'd been an earthquake and there was a tsunami coming and not sure when it was going to arrive. I think Australians did kind of settle, and I think we've done well. And some of those people then went into a full COVID pandemic. So we've had that research and we're following up on all of that, as I said before. I was involved in the pandemic kindness movement, setting up the web page and contributing to material around that. There were just so many things that we were trying to do. I was called over as part of the COVID response for the employment assistance at the PA. Looking after staff over there, which we were very fortunate really that COVID had minimal impact on the hospital at the time. And so I guess it's really, I think what it's really brought to the fore with what's happened with COVID is, you know, well-being previously, people used to talk about hydration and exercise and do some mindfulness, and we've really had to look at what is the core of well-being. And I guess what I quite I frequently try to teach is that, you know, it's also so important to still have personal growth and development, meaning making, engagement. And so that's about that my work makes sense to me and I understand it. And I think if COVID has taught us anything is that our staff, the commitment they have to care of patients is phenomenal. The majority of people, you know, they're not there for the money or for the financial stability. There was a call to arms really around the world for healthcare professionals that this is going to put yourself and your family at risk. Mm-hmm. And in our survey, nearly 100% of people believed they would be at direct personal risk and potentially their families as well. And certainly a lot of those people we interviewed overseas last year had moved out, were living in hotels for fear of that. Mm-hmm. But people were also saying, I believe, because we asked a question, do you think you can grow during this experience? And it was nearly like 85, 88% said yes. Do you think you can demonstrate resilience? And people said yes. So the human spirit, the capacity to give is enormous. And again, it's a great resource and one that we should never, ever take for granted and one that we need to keep fostering and looking after all of those other components to thank people for bringing their skills and bringing their talents and bringing their compassion, even when it's hard.
It really is phenomenal what we've seen from our frontline clinicians.
Absolutely. And that's the same within Australia, you know, everywhere, because really at any given day, as Victoria has shown, as things change, you know, rapidly, we're always 14 days away from a pandemic. You know, we can't know that, and people have had to give the same exceptional care, whatever level they're involved in, whether you're the GP or you're in oral health somewhere, the same level of care, often with now thinking about spacing, without having proper holidays, without being always able to go to the gym or utilise our skills that we've developed over sometimes years in, to protect us, to keep us going from this work. And we've added all this complexity and people have just kept going.
From a well-being perspective, is having something like a holiday to look forward to one way of looking after ourselves? And I think that's been a difficult thing during COVID because we haven't really been able to do that.
Look, I think lots of people do use that for well-being, but the science is really against it. Because even if you took an 8-week holiday overseas, it says that the protective factor for that lasts about 12 to 18 days. Like you've really got to savour it. You've got to almost mindfully take yourself back, picture yourself, imagining yourself back in that holiday. And whereas most people, you know, you know yourself, you see them on the Thursday after an 8-week holiday and you go, oh, how was your sleep? Oh, I can't even remember it. You know, we've got to find these kind of microwaves of protecting ourselves every day. And that might be, it's 10 o'clock, have I had a drink of water? Have I gone to the bathroom? Having worked in critical care for a very long time, I always have nuts and dried apricots and stuff so that if I couldn't stop for lunch, I could quickly go and shovel some food in and just keep myself going, because if it's one thing that I desperately am not good at, it's being hangry. So having, I think the first tool of well-being is self-awareness. You know, what is it that's your triggers? You know, like some people need 10 hours sleep a night. Some people need, like me, need to eat regularly. Some people need to do some sort of physical exercise. And, you know, when we were all in lockdown, we had to get creative about that. I was doing online dancing and all sorts of things as a way of keeping ourselves going. And that can't stop. You know, as a healthcare professional, you've got to keep that to the fore all the time, because many people, you know, they're rushing around at the start of a shift because they've got young children and they're trying to get sorted and, you know, might have had a difficult drop off at daycare, and then it's go, go, go. What do you then do to calm yourself, to assure yourself, when really your brain wants to say, you're a terrible mother, why did you drop your child to childcare? Why are you working? About ways of stopping that and saying, okay, why did I drop my child at daycare today? I need to earn money, because I need to keep us safe and in a house that feels safe for us at night and somewhere where I tuck them into bed and we know that that's a place of security for them. When I'm at work today, what is something that I really want to consciously do because it's meaningful to me? You know, it's about constantly just checking in with ourselves. What can we do for ourselves? And then there's also organisational responsibilities, leaders' responsibilities, and also who we want to be in the tribe that day at work.
And what if you're on a shift with someone who is particularly stressed that day and isn't being very kind to you? How can you look after yourself in that situation when you've just got to keep going?
First of all, I always say to people, if that's not that person's normal way of being, please go over and say, hey, how are things going? I've noticed that you're not quite yourself. You know, don't go over and go, you're being grumpy and you're affecting the whole team. But just go over, or if you know what they drink, go and get them a coffee or an apple juice and say, hey, I'm a little bit worried about you today. You know, because sometimes when people are stressed and busy, they've lost that situational awareness and not aware. So most people apologise and settle down. If you have someone really toxic in your team, particularly if you're a leader and you're listening to this, it's really worth addressing that, because that emotional contagion will spread through your team and you'll lose all the good people. They'll move out, people will vote with their feet, and you'll be left with the toxic individual. So it's really worth addressing that, because it does have a massive influence on the way people perceive work, how they can enjoy work, and everybody's well-being.
Liz, what do you think will change after the pandemic in terms of staff well-being?
That's really hard to know for sure, but I guess what I would really encourage people who have to make decisions about money is that really, when you pay someone to do staff well-being, they should be able to pay for themselves. You know, it should be really, you should see reductions in sick leave. You should see reductions in absenteeism. We've got a lot of people in leadership roles in health who've never done any leadership training, who aren't sure how to help a team function. So I would hope that one of the things that COVID has been able to teach us is that those investments then pay off a thousandfold if people can keep their teams functioning well and individuals functioning well. I think what I'm hoping has changed, I had a huge frustration with the burnout research before COVID, and now, of course, people are saying, I genuinely feel burnt out, and I actually think that's true. I think COVID, for so many reasons, personally and professionally, has really caused massive fatigue. But Christine Maslach, who first brought out the Maslach Burnout Inventory, for which all this research is backed up, says over and over and over again since the beginning of its, you know, implementation in 1996, that burnout is not an individual deficit. Burnout was never, ever meant as a prognosis or a diagnosis, that burnout is actually often around a kind of disconnection between values, where an individual has a value systems or a belief and can't make those values work within an organisation. So it's got burnout's got a huge systemic kind of approach to it if it's done properly. And in 2016, Maslach and Leiter brought out this whole thing about, we've got to stop this whole binary thing about burnout and not burnt out. So what they've done is created these five profiles of workplace experience, of which burnout is at one end, and at the other end of the continuum is engagement. And in between, if people have got high depersonalization or cynicism, then they're disengaged. They're not burnt out. And if people are complaining that the workload is just too huge, it's unachievable, and they've got high emotional exhaustion but they're okay in the other two sectors, then we call that overextended, not burnt out. And then if people feel like they can't achieve and their personal accomplishment or their professional efficiencies aren't being met, then that's ineffective. And what I think is, if people can stop talking just burnout, yes, no, if we can start A, really having some self-reflection, what is it that is driving me nuts about work? What is it that's making me feel exhausted? What is it that's just feel soul-destroying about going into work? That's the first thing, to really work that out. Are you working too longer hours? Is it a job you still get reward from? Is it meaningful? Do you have good relationship with your team members, with your leaders? Are you, you know, is your value system still in good, healthy condition? And the other thing is if we're going to do the burnout research, can we please use the tool as it was meant to be used? Can we please report on it accurately? And if we know that 20% of our workforce is disengaged and highly cynical, which for me, I think is worse than burnout, because we don't want people who are cynical and depersonalized towards their patients and their staff, you know, their staff colleagues. You can do something about it. It will actually allow us to target our interventions in a way that's helpful. So I'm hoping that as we move forward, we're going to stop this terrible merry-go-round of research with no interventions, and do something similar to what's happening in Metro North at the moment, where we're trying to infiltrate and support and scaffold and give people tools, knowing that one size will never fit all with wellbeing, and that we've got to help people understand themselves, and then we've got to make sure that we've got rosters that are fair and transparent, that people have enough time to have a break, that we're conscious of our registrars and fellows who are trying to juggle life and adulthood and parenting and exams, that we're not running people ragged, that we're not, that, you know, when people are doing research, we're creating some space for them to do that. All of those things, if we can take, you know, our commitment to staff that we've had around COVID and continue it on, I think it will be revolutionary for health.
Liz, if staff are struggling with work and life pressures, what would be your advice?
You know, Nora Jones, mm-hmm. I know this is showing my age, but she has a lovely song called Things You Don't Have to Do. And the lyrics say things, isn't it just a little crazy sometimes to find the life that you thought that you had to live by, to remind yourselves about the things that you don't have to do. And I don't know what happened where busyness became a sign of popularity and success. And I say this over and over again, you meet people and you say, how are you? And they say either busy or tired. Oh, and then it becomes a competition, like who's busier, who's tired, who's more successful. You know, because if someone said to us, look, I'm really relaxed and I'm calm, we'd be like, oh, you're not achieving anything in life then, are you? Whereas I'd actually think more than ever, we need to really stop and think, do our kids need to do every type of dancing and play futsal and be at speech drama and go to those three birthday parties they were invited to? I'd really encourage people to pause and think, what fills your tank and what depletes your tank? And people were teasing me last night. They asked me to do something on a Sunday and I said, Sunday night for me is ironing and folding. And if I put anything in after 6 o'clock, I'm ironing and folding at 2 a.m. and I can't do it anymore. It's about having this level of awareness, like, have you actually designated time in your days off to do something that fills your bucket? That might be an afternoon rest. It might be visiting the library and reading a book with your kids. It may be a long bubble bath. You know, it doesn't have to be something that costs money, but it's about a sanctioning of time. And I think, again, you know, like, I think there's been a lot of people who've been hugely disadvantaged, and I'm not talking about economics and things like that, but I think there was a lot of people who forced lockdown made them go, and I think, you know, I'd really encourage people, as more and more people get vaccinated and hopefully things like lockdowns happen less and less, that we don't go back to this terrible, crazy life where it's like, what am I achieving? What am I doing? Because if you are in a healthcare professional, the thing that you have done that's been of most value today, everyone, might have been get a blanket for an elderly person who was cold in outpatients. And if you want to continue to be a compassionate, engaged, you know, professional, then you've got to create some space in your home life to look after yourself. And I think it's, you know, it's an old cliche, but it's a good one, is that for those of you who can remember ever flying on an airline, they would say in the unlikely event of a disaster, a mask will fall down from the ceiling. Please secure your mask on yourself first before assisting others. And, you know, if you just took 30 minutes a day to go for a walk 3 times a week, you might find that you're a better dad, a better husband, a better, you know, nurse, a better, you know, the things that are important to you by just taking a little bit of time back and doing something that fills your tank.
It can be difficult though to say no, and I'm one of those people who struggles with that, which then makes it difficult to take that time back for yourself.
We need to think of no not as a negative. It's a yes to yourself. And I know that sounds very trite, and I've been a single parent. I believe you me, trying to study, do a PhD, work full time, be involved in these other extracurricular things, find things to time to study. Like, it's all a juggle. But there have been times when I've said to the kids, sorry, we might have to have toasted sandwiches tonight. And your kids don't care. They see it as a – they're glad they're not eating broccoli. So it's like, how do we constantly find this balance of, if I add this into my life, what will that mean for how my home is going to run? What will that mean for my work? And, you know, you might even just have a little mantra of, you know, is this going to pay the bills? Is this going to fill my cup? Is this going to give me more time with people I love? Is this something that's going to excite me? And that can be anything from being asked to someone's engagement party to participating in some research. And if it's not ticking those boxes, then please don't prioritise it. You know, healthcare professionals should be very good at triage, and we need to triage our own well-being. And part of the way we do that is by triaging where we invest our time and energy outside of work.
Well, Liz, it's been great having you with us this morning. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.